Serve It Cold, episode 16. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Per your request for an informal review of the incident last October in the Lake Catherine, Rigolette's environment of Louisiana, the arrangements and actions of the DEA Joint Interdiction Task Force are well known to you. The testimony of the only witness to come forward, one Jonathan Creedmoor Speed, can be summed up as follows. John Turner, bail bondsman of Catherine, Mississippi, had taken on a high-profile skip trace case. Mr. Speed became involved in this case at Mr. Turner's request. Mr. Turner had gotten a tip that his target, Alphonsus Anastasia Alba, wanted in New Jersey on conspiracy to commit murder, would be on a cabin cruiser anchored at certain coordinates. Mr. Speed was ignorant of the cruiser's coordinates and followed Mr. Turner to the rendezvous point in a separate boat. In Mr. Speed's own words, when we got there, all hell broke loose. Mr. Speed lost track of Mr. Turner in the general melee that followed, but found 10 Hispanic men, all with injuries, in the water shortly thereafter. Mr. Speed states that he had very little communication with these men, due to ignorance of Spanish on his part and of English on theirs. The 11 men proceeded to drift for 2 days in an open boat with little water until finally landing at the Rigolette's lighthouse. Although hindered by the loss of his prescription glasses during the boat journey, Mr. Speed, as the least injured and most familiar with the area, proceeded to go for help. Mr. Speed claims that, after getting a few hundred yards into the brush and losing sight of the surviving Hispanic men, he heard shots coming from the direction of the lighthouse. Fearing for his life, he did not return to the lighthouse at that time, but proceeded further east into the marsh until he came out at a fish camp. Louisiana State Police investigated Mr. Speed's claim of a shooting at the Rigolette's lighthouse, but found no bodies nor evidence of a shooting. Mr. Speed has specifically stated that he has not seen or heard from John Turner since that night and has otherwise cooperated fully with law enforcement. Should you have any further questions or require additional details about this incident, please contact my office.
We hit the Catherine city limits at about 6 o'clock. The cell phone had been silent the entire trip home, a testament to Gojo's self-control. I imagined that he had had a stressful day. Our first stop was at Vera's store. I was happy to see George already at the register for the night. Darlene and I went back and found Vera working on the day's logs. She looked up.
Did you tell Jimmy Buffett I'm mad as hell at him for writing that damn song?
I threw my hand to my forehead. Oh, no. I completely forgot to mention it to him. Of course, I only saw him a half a dozen times while I was down there, and we were real busy whipping some lyrics into shape before he goes into the studio this weekend. But on the positive side, dear, he's promising to name the new album after you. Vera and the American Way. By the way, Gerald and Delta send you their love. John Goodman says he's anxious to get up here and taste your lasagna. Anne Rice wants to know if you'll help edit her new book, and poor Aaron is just frantic to get you to work on that duo album you promised to do with him. Oh yeah, Elvis wants you to quit spreading rumors about him. After giving me a hug and a peck, Vera threw me to one side and said,
You must be Narlene. Welcome home, dear.
Vera took Narlene in her arms, and Narlene burst into tears. This was not an unusual reaction for people meeting Vera for the first time. I figured that if things progressed as usual, within a minute Narlene would be telling Vera her deepest fears and most closely held secrets. So I decided it was time to go check in with the troops. I toted my cell back out to the van for some privacy. Gojo told me that the files had been taken care of, and he was trying to tape all TV stories about Landis's death. I told Goat that we were in town, and that I would have Narlene at the cradle within the hour. I asked him if he would like to come to my house later for a meeting about both of my cases. He jumped at the invitation. Lurker had found no bugs at the house or in Vera's car, but he had found two at each store, one under each register counter, and one in each office. On a hunch, I called Gigi Castor. When he answered, I said, "Gigi, you'll never guess what happened. I found 4 illegal listening devices in our stores. Can you believe it? We've been bugged. I just had B&E come by, and they got some good fingerprints off a couple of these things. I'm on my cell phone now. We're headed over to the FBI office. They've got that new fingerprint computer, and Officer Barton thinks we'll have these scumbags behind bars by daylight. Just thought I'd let you know." I disconnected. 15 seconds later, the phone rang. Gigi said,
"Speed, I don't think we need to be worrying the FBI over a couple of bugs in a mini-mart."
"Well, that's okay, Gigi. Barton says that the feds are anxious to give this new computer some real-world testing. Says it won't be a bother at all."
"Speed, don't take those things to the FBI office. That's an order."
"Gigi, I'm in the back of the police car right now. I don't see as I have any choice in the matter." "Gigi, I'm afraid that somebody's about to set us up for a robbery."
"Speed, those are my devices. I didn't break any laws. It's not illegal for a man to monitor his own businesses. Damn you, don't you let my personal property be given to the FBI. I want you to deliver them to me."
"You were spying on us? Now I understand. I'll make a deal with you, Gigi. I'll give your bugs back as soon as you give the one back I planted in your office last month. It's behind the electrical outlet box on your south wall. Sound like a fair trade?"
"God damn you, sorry son of a bitch! You're fired, you hear me, Speed?"
"Sorry, Gigi, I think you already fired me for this week. One per customer per week is the store policy. Bye now." I walked back into the store and asked George if he could give someone a call and talk for a few minutes. He gave me a puzzled look and I said, "Gigi."
"Gotcha, JC. I've been meaning to call my mother all day."
When I got back to the office, the crying stage had ended, and the two women were drinking hot tea and talking about me. I know that's a little egocentric on my part, but all conversation did halt when I entered the room. I said to Vera, "Before you believe a word she says about me mistreating her, you need to take a look at the bruise on my shoulder your sweet Miss Hospitality gave me." This bit of brilliant repartee didn't give me anything but a couple of, "Oh, he's back," looks. Of course, that didn't stop me. Vera, "Lurker didn't find anything at home, but there were 2 bugs right here at your store." She looked up, startled, with the beginnings of outrage forming in her eyes. I said, "Don't worry. Lurker already took them away. There were 2 at my store, too. Guess who put them there?"
"Grantham?"
"No. Not the murderous Latimer Grantham. Your own dear boss, G.G. Castor, had those bugs planted for his own listening enjoyment."
"That sorry son of a bitch. Wait till I get my hands on his skinny neck."
"Please, baby, let's get through one murder at a time. There'll be plenty of time next week to kill Gigi at leisure. Besides, with any luck, he'll have electrocuted himself by then." We scattered to run the errands that inevitably pushed their way into the glamorous lives of all mini-mart managers. I ran Narlene by the cradle and drove to my store to burn my pictures and work files onto CD. As I pulled into the parking lot, my cell phone rang. It was Gojo.
"Don't even think about parking in your usual place. Somebody showed Homer how to use an air stem wrench. I parked my truck over here this morning and had 2 flat tires before I knew what was happening. Park right in front of the door. Better yet, park over at the house."
I pulled up to the Jackson house that sat across the street from the store. Gojo's magnificent black and tan German shepherd sailed off the front porch in full throat. I opened my door and offered the back of my left hand to the dog. He gave a last perfunctory woof and ran to piss on all my tires before Old Blue could leave unmarked. Sister Seeley was rocking on the front porch, a pan of late-crop butter beans in her lap.
"Well, Johnny, welcome home. I see you've done heard about what our little hoodlum is up to now. Don't worry, Old Brute'll watch your van."
Old Brute, who was actually Champion A2 Brute IV, and only 2.5 years old at the time, peered at my side at the mention of his name, looking to see if Seeley wanted me killed, maimed, or just intimidated. I knelt to pet him. "He's looking mighty good, Sister Seeley. Must be all the butter beans you feed him."
"You're right there, Johnny. I feed Brute anything I eat. As long as Gojo isn't around, that is. My diet hasn't hurt me too much, and I figure it ought to be good enough for my dog. I'll tell you one thing. When we go to all those fancy shows, there's not a dog there whose coat shines like his. Not a one." But Johnny, did you get our girl back home safe and sound?
Yes, ma'am. I imagine she's over trying to explain to her mother how she wandered off and came back with a head full of blonde hair.
Blonde? Narlene Moore? Johnny, you're going to have somebody besides Homer Blue trying to do you in. No, I was a blonde at one time. Oh, don't you look so shocked, Johnny Speed. I wasn't born an old lady school teacher. Fact is, I was born right here in this house. My father built this house, and when I was growing up, Mobile Street was in its heyday. I could sit up here and watch the whole street light up every night, hear that music bouncing on up the hill right at me. I just couldn't wait until I got old enough to get dressed up and go down that hill to hear Bo Carter and Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, Cooney Vaughn.
You heard the juke band, Celie.
Oh, yeah. Of course they weren't the Mississippi juke band but just a little while, but they played together quite a bit. And Cooney Vaughn was the cat's pajamas in Crosstown all through those Depression days.
Was he as good as they say?
Oh, good and better. He could play ragtime and jazz and classical, blues, the whole works. And Blind Roosevelt had one of those voices that would just make you fall out in the aisles. You know, the Graves brothers were big in gospel in their time. They used to come to sing at the church. But, you know, nobody talks about Ulroy Graves anymore. Ulroy could make one little old tambourine sound like a whole drum set. And before you ask, I don't know if they invented rock and roll. If they did, nobody told us about it back then, but those boys were cooking the soup for sure. Anyway, Johnny, I want to thank you for taking care of Narlene. Gojo was about worried sick.
Gojo? Gojo's got a thing for Narlene?
Well, they've had some kind of thing since Narlene was a tiny baby and Gojo was a toddler. They were inseparable as kids. Since junior high, it seems they've been chasing each other, and you know how it is. When one's hot, the other's automatically cold.
Come to think of it, I believe Gojo has been going out of his way to not mention Narlene all week. And I don't think she's ever said his name in my presence but maybe once. I think you're on to something, Sister Celie. But they just might both be running hot for a change. When I walked into the store, I was whistling the juke band's Dangerous Woman. I knew it was a bad sign. It's one of those tunes you just can't get out of your head. Before long, I'd be humming it or whistling it without thinking. I knew that it was inevitable that sometime in the next day or so, Vera would turn to me and ask, "Now just which Dangerous Woman are you obsessing about right now, Johnny Speed?" How she knows I'm not whistling That's All Right, Mama or Folsom Prison Blues is beyond me. Gojo had called Sandra in so he could meet with the rest of the team that night. It also freed him up to help me transfer my pictures. In fact, he actually seemed eager to help. Within an hour, we had everything in triplicate on CD and wiped my download hard drive clean by writing zeros to it. One set of CDs would go into the secret panel built into the side of old Blue's wheel well safe until I could get it into my safety deposit box the next morning. Gojo volunteered to take the two other sets of CDs to the cradle, but when we came out from the back, Narlene and Sonny were coming in the front door. Narlene had changed clothes yet again, and Sonny looked human again, if you could overlook the multicolored bruises that covered every inch of skin that was visible. He looked like the end of a really bad Photoshop filter application. I introduced Sonny to Gojo. Gojo and Narlene didn't acknowledge each other's existence. Goat had sent the two to offer us the use of the vault for the meeting that night. I said, "That is a great idea, especially since that's where all the files are. I need to go call Vera right now and tell her to quit cleaning the damn house for company. Lurker ought to be there with her doing some work for me. I'll call in an order for some pizza while I'm at it."
"Nah, don't bother. Sonny and I are headed out to get some food. Meet back at the cradle at 8?
"Okay. It's a date. See y'all there."
"I thought you were an English teacher, Jonathan."
"What, y'all?" "Y'all" is perfectly fluent American English, Southern Region dialect. Second person, plural pronoun, a useful element lacking in other regional subsets, except for the awful yous of the Middle Atlantic states and the less objectionable but sexist you guys from New England. Of course, these two variations were doomed to meet in eastern boroughs of New York, forming the splendidly horrid yous guys.
"Wow. I wish you had been my English teacher."
"I don't think so. Not even for a millisecond.
I already have to listen to this stuff all day long from him at work, and Grandma at home.
Gojo left with Sonny and Narlene, while I hid our third set of discs in Old Blue and made some more phone calls. I decided to leave Old Blue under Brute's care and walk to the cradle. Celie had abandoned her bean-shelling perch for the night, but I could feel her with me, blonde hair and all, as I walked down the long hill toward the heart of Crosstown. Vera and Lurker drove up to the cradle just as I was approaching. To my untrained eye, it looked like the remodeling project was actually regressing. Where the front door used to be was now a gaping hole at least 40 feet wide. We wound our way through along a path marked by construction clip-on lights and climbed up to the vault loaded down with Diet Coke, ginger cookies, and Lurker's bug-sweeping equipment. At the top of the staircase, I had the great pleasure of introducing Lurker 76 by his given name, Robin Call Windsong. Oh, the horrors of having baby boomers as parents. After Lurker made sure that he couldn't make me melt by simply glaring at me, he busied himself with snooping around the unique room's electrical and data systems. The rest of us took seats at Goat's big conference table. On the table was a feast of Catherine's highest culinary treasure, barbecue from Letha's. While everyone else did their best to eat all the ribs before I could get started, I told a careful version of the story of both of my current cases. Watching the barbecue disappear at an alarming rate contributed to my brevity. I also brought up the encore appearance of the Blueberry SOG and my growing suspicion that both of the cases might be connected. Then I took my turn eating while we all watched the video that Gojo had taped from the TV. The first glimpse of Latimer and Lily arriving at the police station startled me and immediately had me doubting my core hypothesis. Lily was very Veronica Lake, white sundress, scarf over her head, dark shades. But Latimer's face was ashen, the very look of grief. Could it have actually been coincidence? Had Landis truly been my client? At the very least, I was now in doubt of who the real actor was in the Lily-Latimer relationship. But the very next video clip reassured me. It was stock footage of Landis from the day he was named director of the new Petroleum Institute. The moment he opened his mouth, I knew that Landis Grantham was not the person who had called me and hired me to snoop on his wife and brother. It was close, but it wasn't Landis. When all the video clips had ended, I could feel myself drowning in a flood of questions. I couldn't think where to start. We all sat in silence more than long enough to make all of us extroverts nervous. Of course, Lurker didn't notice. I rose and walked over to Goat's new whiteboard. Carefully avoiding the football plays that were now covering half the board, I wrote, Hypothesis 1. Latimer and Lily hired me to document their alibis during the time that Landis was killed. Hypothesis 2. Raganet and Joachim are involved in Latimer's plot.
Don't you need a no hypothesis for each of those?
Everybody turned and looked at him as if he had sprouted wings. He looked around the table and stammered,
Oh, come on, Narlene. You actually came to my graduation when I got my master's degree.
Sure, Go, but I didn't know you really went to class and everything.
While Goat and Narlene continued, I turned back to the board and wrote, Latimer and Lily did not hire me. L&L had nothing to do with Landis's murder. L&L don't know Ray and Jerry. All is chaos and chance. The search for truth is naught but empty illusion. How's that for a blanket null hypothesis? Guys, I don't really know how to solve this squirming mass of problems, but until we can prove these two things, I don't know how we can kill this beast. And believe you me, we do have to kill it, because this critter is dangerous to every one of us, with the possible exception of Lurker. I sat back down and continued. Although I love sitting here with friends and eating barbecue, I really didn't drag all of you into this for the fun of it. I'm afraid that I got everyone involved before I left for New Orleans. I think that the PI that I was warned about by the fake Landis has probably been watching me for the last few days, and to make matters worse, I've not been able to spot a tag. That means he or she may have seen me have contact with all of you. Add to that the fact that somewhere there is a 1 gallon plastic bag, a very potent pot, just chock full of fingerprints. Narlene's, mine, Sonny's, Joachim's, and Raganet's, just to name a few. Narlene's fingerprints are also all over the Bonneville that they drove up here the first time. This is the same car that I told B&E to look for. It's also probably still sitting in the custody of the New Orleans Police Department. If I don't go to the cops pretty soon with my pictures, I expect the happy couple will start getting antsy. Speaking of the cops, although I would never let them know this, B&E are damn good investigators. It won't take long for them to come looking for me. In fact, I expect that B&E will want to talk to everyone in this room in the next week. When that happens, be calm and don't lie. Oh, and don't let what the cops say to you influence what you say to them. Remember this. They can and will lie to you to get what they want.
Johnny, I think all your little hypotheses are quite cute, but I think we don't need to draft an experimental regime. What we need is an action plan.
Vera rose and walked to the whiteboard.
What is our mission? What is it that we want to accomplish?
Gojo ventured. Don't we need to prove who killed Landis Grantham? Vera wrote it down. I jumped in. No, we don't have to solve the murder case. We have...
Johnny, we're brainstorming here. Every idea is valid and worth considering. You'll get to rip things to shreds in a minute. Now, other suggestions for our mission?
After 5 minutes of suggesting and ripping, the board read. Mission. To find evidence that will protect the members of the crack investigative team from lawful prosecution, unlawful search and seizure, extortion, or blackmail.
Now, we need an action plan to fulfill the mission. What action can we take that will accomplish this mission statement?
Gojo held up his hand this time. I think we need to take the action of finding out who killed Landis Grantham. I promise that I didn't think I groaned out loud, but one look from Vera told me otherwise. Just then, my cell phone rang. While the others carried on, I answered and heard Butch Ellis's voice.
You damn egghead. You don't need no null hypothesis and you don't need no touchy-feely action plan. What you need is a damn motive. And I think Gojo is right. You really do need to find out who killed Landis Grantham.
Oh, shit.
Well said, Speedy.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com. Hey, Servant Cold fans. Paul and I want to really thank you all for staying subscribed through our hiatus. We apologize for the bumpy ride. We had made plans to post episodes 14 and 15 from the road, but unanticipated technical difficulties, no internet, put the kibosh on those plans. We hope you feel it was worth the wait, and we don't intend to keep you on the hook any longer. We are back on track for releasing episodes weekly from now until the very end. So, as a thank you for sticking with Johnny C while the production company took a road trip to Japan for 3 weeks, here's a great song from Michelle Malone's Sugarfoot album, Winter Muscadine.
Hand me a lover who didn't treat me right. We're fighting and crying, wore me down. While I was making a red that line, cheat was making time. Once was sweet, grew so sour on the vine. Now it tastes like a winter muscadine. Well, I walked on downtown for to find the man who helped turn my tears into a smile. We ducked down the alley just like we usually planned, but his wife was a waiting crocodile. What once was sweet grew so sour on the vine. Now it tastes like a winter muscadine. Let me be. Sunshine, yeah, suck it up like southern kind, yeah, and it still tastes like muscadine.